The penultimate speaker is Greg Brick, who is the author of Subterranean Twin Cities and Iowa Underground, A Guide to the State's Subterranean Treasures, recent PhD of the U of M. And this talk will be Thermal Pollution Under Minneapolis.
Lights. 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 Hi. Hi there. Okay, well, in terms of our theme today, my talk will involve topics in recharge, infiltration, drainage, et cetera, and involving a real puzzle that I've been trying to figure out for several years. And the title of the talk is Thermal Pollution of Groundwater, but you have to understand, as it will be obvious from some of the case studies that I'm just going to briefly review, not everyone regards it as thermal, as pollution, actually. They actually view it as something good. Just as a real simple example of how heat can be used as a groundwater tracer, this is from Mary Anderson's big review article in 2005, and she gives this figure showing some induced recharge through pumping. So the in pumping this groundwater here, it's pulling river water in, and of course, it's increasing the temperature of that. And this is nothing new. It goes back to Slichter in 1905 when he actually first pointed out there's a pond in Long Island that was drawing in surface water and changing the temperature of the groundwater. There's a really interesting recent study by Yelsin and Yedeman in Turkey, and this involves a suburb of Istanbul or Constantinople, and I'm not going to try to pronounce that, but what they did is they measured the temperature of groundwater in this suburb, in its springs and wells. And they noticed that when you average everything out, that the groundwater temperature is about 3.5 degrees Celsius above what they call rural groundwater, or the ordinary groundwater at that latitude. And these wells were and springs were in karstic limestone. And what they, the big point of their article was not only to show how much what a difference urbanization can make in terms of groundwater temperature, but also in terms of that the concept of an urban heat island, or UHI as they call it. It not only affects the SAT, or the surface air temperature, but also affects the ground and the groundwater beneath it, and elevates that temperature. So that's the big point there. But they did not view this as a bad thing. They did not view it as pollution, because in this particular place, in this part of Turkey, they're really big on using heat pumps for space heating in winter. And so with these kind of open systems, water will be pumped out of the ground, the heat extracted and utilized, and the water put back in, but it's just, it's slightly elevated temperature. We keep doing this year after year, and the groundwater as a whole, warms up. And that was largely what the effect was. And again, they saw this as something positive rather than a pollution aspect of pollution. Now, with our neighbors to the north, in Winnipeg, it was a different story. Again, the same kind of bedrock carbonate, this karstified limestone. And what they noted, what Ferguson and Woodbury noticed, is that when you put these cooling systems, like we used to do in Minneapolis in the bad old days. I pump, in summer, pump groundwater up and use it for air conditioning. What they found is that with these systems here, where the water is put back in the ground, the temperature around the injection well is going to be elevated. And whereas that's good if you're looking to get the heat out, it's, you know, if you're looking for a cooling system, that's actually a bad thing. And these systems begin to interfere. And they marked out here A, B, C, and D, which are large buildings in downtown Winnipeg. So they found this to be the thermal pollution indeed to be a nuisance. Another study by Lerner, this one of a different character. This is a pretty interesting happening. Lerner studied the water supply system of Lima in Peru, and he did a water budget on it. And it's very well known how much water went out of the water treatment plant and into the system. And then you could go compare that with the, just do a summation of all the meters at the downstream end of the pipe, the water that people are actually receiving. What he found is that there's actually a 40% loss of water in this system. There's a substantial amount of this water leaking out into the underlying alluvial aquifers in Lima. And then he was able to confirm that with looking at the chemistry of the water. In this case, fluoride, because fluoride's added. That was found in the water in the aquifer itself. So you knew that's where the leakage was going. That and various other lines of evidence. So the recharge you see here, you might think that's from rainfall or something. That's actually the recharge from the leaking pipe system, from the leaking water mains in Lima, which is just right down here. So that brings me to my topic and the area that I studied. And this is the largest cave under downtown Minneapolis. It has various names, the Manhole Cave, the Farmers and Mechanics Bank Cave, because it lies right under what had been the old Farmers and Mechanics Bank back in the day. And this outline here shows the location of this cave. And you can see here's Marquette, here's 2nd Avenue, this is 4th Street. And then you can see the cave entrance there. And it's a little bit deceiving because from this photo, from this image, it almost looks like you just sort of like enter a cave opening right along 4th Street, but that's not the case. There's actually a manhole there and a 75-foot shaft down into this cave, so that's an illusion. So this cave is actually in the St. Peter sandstone fairly far below street level. Now, the cave was discovered in 1904, and there were every once in a while there was a newspaper article about this cave, and this is probably the most dramatic one. This was by a journalist by the name of David Dornberg in 1939, and he took what he called his so-called camera safari through the lost world under the loop. Kind of dramatizing the situation. But you can see the outline of the cave there. It's actually pretty good. This appeared in the newspaper, but that's because it was based on an actual survey that had been done years earlier. So he had something to work with. And you can see here, he came down through that shaft, and then you can see follow the lines. There's his safari, lions and tigers and everything, or what have you. But I want to show you on this map, there are several features of groundwater interests that are relevant here. And one of them is just simply the outline of the cave as just a first-order observation. You'll notice that it's very irregular. It's a maze cave in the sandstone layer. This suggests that it's not artificial in origin, that it's probably largely natural. But my own opinion after looking at the records of this cave and so on over the years is that it actually does have some what I call not natural but anthropogenic. There's some anthropogenic component here. Because if you look here, you see a lot of the cave passages stop right over the 4th Street Tunnel. And I don't think that's a coincidence. This is the tunnel, which runs at a level lower than the cave, is actually a sink for sediments in the cave, and they can flow in there and enlarge the cave. And I think that had a... So the cave is, to some extent, a little bit of a washout there. Another groundwater feature is the old artesian well. It's kind of interesting to think that there might be a flowing artesian well in downtown Minneapolis, you know, given that how, you know, how much the groundwater contours there have dropped. But the real important thing here is this one here. On his safari, he noted a feature that he called Little Minnehaha Falls. And it is basically a spring that comes out of the ceiling of the cave and drops down from the ceiling onto the floor. And some poetic sewer worker of generations past had named it Little Minnehaha Falls after the big one, of course. And here's a photograph of Little Minnehaha Falls, and it doesn't quite do it justice. You actually need to get some side lighting here. Actually, it is more dramatic than seen in this photograph. There is a big curling sheet of water about 10 feet long, and it comes out of a bedding plane here. And what you're seeing up here is that is the bottom of the Mifflin member of the Platteville limestone. Okay, and then what you see here is the lowermost member of the Platteville limestone, the Pecatonica, and that is a much thinner member than the Mifflin. And in a lot of the excavations in the Twin Cities, in a lot of the brewery caves and so on, this thin pecatonica layer will drop away if they carve the passage out wide enough. And that's what has happened here. The pecatonica has dropped away, revealing this bedding plane where the water is coming out. And it hasn't been accurately measured. But I would estimate it's at about 5 gallons per minute. And as you can see, deposit some really colorful, what we call zebra flowstone on the wall there, the mineral deposits of all different colors. But the really remarkable thing about this ceiling spring, this Little Minnehaha Falls, and with regard to this topic, is that I had a thermometer with me, a good quality mercury thermometer, and I measured the temperature of this spring at 19 degrees centigrade. And of course, you know, the expected groundwater temperature around here would be more like 8 degrees centigrade. So this is like very warm. I came back several years later, actually 7 years later, and measured it again. And the temperature was 17 degrees centigrade. So there's obviously a little bit of fluctuation there, but significantly elevated above the expected 8 degrees for unaltered groundwater. So what I did is I decided during this second visit that what I would conduct a thermometric survey of all the springs and seeps under Minneapolis that were easily accessible. And this is a map I made of the cave, and along with the temperatures in Celsius as they were on April 15th, 2007. And as you can see, now here's the Little Minnehaha Falls again, about, I guess, 17.1 there. As you can see, the drip waters it's really consistent. They're, you know, it's like 16 to 17 degrees, something like that. So it's a fairly small range of temperature in there. And you sort of know when you go in this cave where to sample, because they have these galvanized troughs to catch water. The Public Works Department, way back when, after they discovered this cave in 1904, they put these troughs in there to catch water from the ceiling joints in order to try to prevent any more erosion so that this cave wouldn't enlarge itself. Because there was serious concern, of course, that this entire thing, there would just be a giant sinkhole would form in downtown Minneapolis. And swallow some buildings. And so they wanted to try to prevent that. Another thing they did is, of course, they put in these concrete piers and so on inside this cave. So what is the source of this water? And where is this heat coming from? I gave the example of Lima in Peru, Lerner's study, where he went there and said, okay, well, this is... he's able to do the water budget, found out that it was leakage from water mains. That one doesn't hold water here because this ceiling spring has been flowing ever since the cave was discovered. This is a very interesting 1907 newspaper article. I told you there were a number of newspaper articles about this cave. Some lurid journalism, and here you see people in nice, you know, suits and coats and stuff, and floating around inside this cave, supposedly right after it was discovered. But they describe in this article in 1907, they say, "Oh, there's that curling sheet of water," so we know we're dealing with the same thing. So now Minneapolis is notorious for some of its large water main breaks. But I don't think this thing would be flowing for 110 years now, that this be some giant leak like this that they hadn't patched. So that appeared to me an improbable explanation. It's water main leakage. So if you look at the surface above the cave with the star marking the location of the cave. And it's like, well, what's up above? You know, is it? And you can, you get a sense right away that this is an impervious area. I mean, this is completely covered with buildings and concrete, bar none. I mean, it's the amount of infiltration here is much lower as it would be as compared to an open field, obviously. And yet the spring is still flowing, supposedly, it's from what I can tell, as abundantly as it did, back in 1904. As far as this goes, there's really nothing on... It can't be, most of the time when you pave something over, the springs will go away or start tapering off, but they haven't done so here. And if you look in detail, well, you see like a little pool of water here in the government plaza, but that's a recent feature. That wasn't around back in 1904. And so just looking at this map of what's above the cave, it's not real obvious what, there could be a natural source or some other source for that. I think if you look at the geologic map of this area, however, with the cave's location marked as a red asterisk, you'll see that we are starting to get kind of close to that northern edge of the Platteville limestone in Minneapolis. And on the if you look at the flow lines for the bedrock units, the groundwater flow lines, they're mostly coming in this direction and in this direction in the underlying Prairie du Chien. It has something to do with the fact that we're getting towards the center of the Twin Cities Artesian Basin here. So the Platteville limestone here dips towards the south or southwest. If you look where those flow lines are coming from, you notice this feature here. This is one of those buried interglacial Mississippi valleys that is largely occupied nowadays by Bassett Creek. But you can see it's quite a wide gash there. And I'm wondering if that has something to do supplying the water to the cave. If we look at this cross section, also from the Hennepin County Geologic Atlas, we can see here some different sorts of hydrogeologic situations in the near vicinity. One of which you could speculate has something to do with the flow in the cave. In the Bassett Creek Valley, you have if you've ever seen excavations there on the near north side of Minneapolis, this very dense blue clay, and that acts as a confining layer in that interglacial river valley. And so the porous glaciofluvial sediments underneath then are water bearing, are under artesian pressure. And if that's, you know, if the feather edge of that Platteville limestone is exposed to that, it's possible that that's another source, a possible natural source for the water that is showing up inside this, the substantial amounts of water are showing up inside this cave. Well, I mentioned I did this thermometric survey inside the cave on one particular day in 2007, but the survey was much larger than that. I also captured all the temperature data for the storm drains under the city of Minneapolis. And here you can see, here's a photograph of some springs in the walls of a tunnel. And they're kind of going off at all kinds of crazy angles. There is lots of infiltration in storm tunnels, generally. But the problem is that very few of those springs, very few of those seeps are actually good for measuring temperature or doing pretty much anything with. And so of that enormous number of springs, you're left with a much smaller number that you can actually sample. And so here's an example of what we call a chalybeate spring, or just one that's depositing iron or ferrohydrite. This iron deposit is actually kind of important and played a role in our selection of which springs to track, because with this very old system, there are spaces outside the walls of these, on the outside of the lining of these tunnels. And during a heavy rain, during a heavy rain event, these spaces, there's little cracks and so on in the walls, and the water inside the tunnel is forced out into those spaces surrounding the tunnel. And that takes several days to drain after the storm ends, and then you'll have water seeping back in. It's basically like what we would call bank storage for a surface stream. So you don't want to be sampling that kind of water. And so if you're sampling a water, maybe perhaps it's depositing iron, it's suggesting perhaps it hasn't been in contact with oxygen before it actually comes out into the tunnel. It was we viewed that as being more important. And here's another photograph of one of those springs. You can see here that whitish sandstone being washed out. And again, over the decades, this sand being piped out from behind the tunnel linings has created these immense voids in these huge spaces behind the walls. And in fact, I think it was in the year 2000, Minneapolis had a huge tunnel collapse in the storm drains, because one of these voids got so big that it had isolated the actual storm tunnel as like a concrete bridge just going through a void until it just got too long, and then the whole thing it just dropped into the hole. So here are some of the results for the notebook here. This is the Washington Avenue storm drain, and the Washington Avenue storm drain forms sort of like a backbone to the Minneapolis drainage system. Okay, so it's almost like having a transect across the city, and so you go and locate the springs that you can actually sample in there and get temperature readings on them. And you can see, you know, a few of those here, 13 degrees centigrade, a chalybeate spring, again, one of those red springs, 14, 12 and a half. And then you can then similar maps were prepared for these tributaries like Nicollet and Hennepin Avenue that come into this big Washington Avenue storm drain. So this is so we get a range here about 12 to 14. And so this is kind of like the remarkable thing, is we are dealing with two very different sets of temperatures in this with this urban groundwater. Okay, this water up in the Platteville is coming out, it's about 16 to 19 degrees for a range, and the water that's coming out in the tunnels is like 12 to 14. So it is, it's elevated but substantially cooler. Again, I can only attribute that, just one guess here, given the limitations of the data set, is that this is because up in the Platteville, it's simply closer to the actual building basements, the heating systems, so on, that heat up the ground. Now, ordinary earth, soil, and so on has a very low thermal conductivity. It's very difficult to transmit heat through it. But I suppose over, decades and decades, this has a cumulative effect. And one of the best researchers in this field, Taniguchi, he has looked at temperature profiles and geothermal gradients under cities, mostly in Asia, such as Tokyo and Bangkok. What he has determined is that you can actually notice that there is some divergence from a geothermal gradient under a city of the size of Tokyo, as deep as 100 meters. And so none of these features under Minneapolis are deeper than 30 meters. So that would suggest, again, that this is a possible mechanism explaining these very elevated temperatures in the groundwater. Then I'll just finish up here with another data set that was more recently collected in the Earth Sciences Department. This is Cold Spring, and this is, of course, the spring which famously supplied water to Fort Snelling, to the soldiers who built Fort Snelling in 1819 and thereafter. And it a fairly large spring, and if you're familiar with it, the spring water comes out about here, enters these large constructed pools, and then flows out down at the other end over a place where you can actually gauge the flow rate there. One of Calvin's students did this as a Europe project. She went down here, set up the data loggers, and got this data. Actually, the temperature was taken every 15 minutes for a full year, so it's a pretty fine-grained data set. What she discovered here is that at Cold Spring, the temperature varies between 11 and 13 degrees centigrade during the course of an ordinary year. And with an offset here, the coldest temperature actually comes in summer. There seems to be like a six-month seasonal lag in there. Now, for the data set that I have, it's just one day. It would be nice to have data loggers like down in this cave and so on to get a very continuous, data set throughout several seasons, see what's going on. But the amazing thing about this, again, is that a French immigre scientist by the name of Nicollet, after whom Nicollet Island is named, he measured the temperature of the water coming out of Cold Spring back in 1836, and he found it to be 8 degrees centigrade. He did a really thorough job. He measured it three times a day for 20 days in succession in the month of July in 1836. So he could get a really good average there. You can see here is that the groundwater temperature nowadays is significantly elevated, even as far out. I mean, cold water is on the city limits of Minneapolis. So even getting out beyond the downtown area, we still see this elevated temperatures, but nothing anywhere near in the range in the Platteville limestone, like down in the cave under the downtown area. So then I've mentioned an explanation for the elevated temperature, just building on previous case studies. It's this urban heat island effect. Sampling points. I think the springs that are used as sampling points in this project, they give you a much finer 3D conception and 3D spatial resolution than you would from using, for example, water well data. If you're using water well data, assuming that your wells are screened at the proper depth and all, it can't even see the some of the things that I've seen in the spring data from the man-made structures and the natural cave down there. In the end, I wasn't all that happy with providing my data to the Minneapolis Public Works Department because to a geologist, springs are interesting things. You might want to go back and measure the temperature again or sample them or something. A public works person seeing a map of springs in the tunnels, it's like, oh my God, we got to start patching. It's like a map, it's like a road map of everything that needs to be patched down there. And so you kind of get this, have a very different perspective on tunnel springs than I do. It's not an interesting scientific problem. So with that, I can take questions or... If anyone here has any suggestions or has made anecdotal observations about this or that in your course of your consulting work, has any insights for me, I'd be glad to entertain them.
Questions for Greg Kelton? Maybe I missed this, but did you measure any sanitary sewer temperatures?
No.
You could just lower down in a manhole.
What's that?
You could just lower something down in a manhole, maybe.
Hey, well, the thing about sanitary sewer temperatures is they should be about 98.6. So I've got that one covered. I took water samples, but it was claimed when I got back to the lab that they had been compromised or contaminated, and so we're not able to use them. Because you have to measure if you want to do an alkalinity, you should do that right away, with the CO2 in there, so you can get a good ion balance and all that. And this happened to me at a time when I just could not get back to the lab with this, and all that work is waiting to be done. I mean, this is a complete set of temperature readings, and indeed water camera that would tell us, that would give us a good idea about the source, very good idea about what the source of this, what the water that's coming out there. I doubt that it could be all, there could be a component of drainage from basements and boiler rooms coming into this spring that's coming out in the bedding plane. But it can't be that much because, spring seems to have retained about the same flow rate through ever since it was discovered till today, which is, it suggests that this is, water is coming from a further distance away that's not impacted by the built-over area of the city.
Greg, over here. Another source of information that may or may not be useful would be sampling records for monitoring wells in the area, because it's more or less standard procedure to do conductivity and temperature and things like that. The temperature may or may not be representative of the actual groundwater at that time, but oftentimes it is pretty close. So that kind of record, I would imagine, would be available, like from the PCA, in terms of groundwater investigations that have been done in the area?
Sure. Yeah, a lot more work definitely needs to be done on it.
Thank you, Greg.